We were discussing Paul's thorn in the flesh at the end of our study last week. We were just getting ready to start with Galatians 4:15. So if you want to turn and follow along with us this morning, we'll be starting in verse 15 of Galatians 4. Starting in verse 15, Paul writes, "Where then is that gratulation of yourselves? For I bear you witness that if possible, you would have plucked out your eyes and given them to me." The New American Standard Bible translates this more properly as, "Where then is that sense of blessing that you had?" The Galatian Christians had received Paul with great enthusiasm, and they were very excited about their newfound Christianity. Paul wanted to know what had happened to that. What had happened to their spirit and their fervor and their excitement that had energized them when he first came to their region and preached the gospel to them. Then he goes on to say, "For I bear you witness that if possible, you would have plucked out your eyes and given them to me." The depth of feeling that the Galatians showed Paul was such that if it had been within their power, they'd have torn their own eyes out and given them to him. We do not know what Paul's infirmity of the flesh was. The Bible never comes right out and says it, but according to many of the commentators and the scholars that I have read, this is the strongest evidence that we have in all of Scripture as to the nature of that infirmity. In either event, it is obvious that they had run from one extreme to the other. When Paul first preached the gospel to them, they embraced it, and they embraced Paul with open arms, fervently, and with great enthusiasm. Now, they had received the teachings of the Judaizers and had abandoned Paul's teachings altogether. We need to keep in mind that this was not an apostasy that was in progress. It was an apostasy that had happened. And we need to remember that. That's very important. It wasn't in progress. The Christians had accepted the teachings of the Judaizers. And Paul wants to know what happened to that great enthusiasm over having been accepted into the family of God. He wants to know where that excitement went, and he gave them an example of just how much he meant to them. This not only served to call to their minds the events surrounding his original preaching, it also served to demonstrate that Paul had no reason whatsoever for being angry with them. He wants them to fully understand that his motives behind his chastisement of them for their defection from Jesus Christ was not fueled by any hard feelings on his part. In other words, Paul has said, I'm using some harsh language here. I'm getting on to you folks about this, but it's not because I think that you've done any wrong to me. It's not out of a grudge. It's not because I'm holding a grudge against you for any reason. And he goes on in verse 16 to say, "So then am I become your enemy by telling you the truth." The Judaizers had been successful in their efforts to bring the Galatian Christians under some form of the old law of Moses. They accomplished this in part by attacking Paul's credibility and apostleship, thereby convincing the Galatians that Paul was an impostor. They managed to persuade the Galatians to accept the idea that Paul had not been preaching the truth to them all along. Paul is writing this letter in response to these claims by the Judaizers. He is directly confronting and refuting everything that the Judaizers had tried to teach them about any part of Judaism. He wants them to understand that he is not their enemy. The Judaizers have been teaching the Jews, or the Gentile Christians, that he was. This entire epistle to them has been all about following after the system of faith in Christ and rejecting the law of Moses completely. Some people just don't want to know the truth. We run into that. I run into that all the time. in my discussions online with people. And when they're confronted by it, they have a negative reaction and consider the messenger to be their enemy instead of someone who's looking out for their best interest. No one likes to be told they're wrong. I don't like to be told when I'm wrong. I don't like it at all. But if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. Paul preached the truth to the Galatian Christians in the beginning. They later allowed the Judaizers to lead them astray into a variant form of doctrine which would cost them their fellowship with God and ultimately their salvation. They were the real enemies that the Galatians needed to be aware of. Paul preached the truth of the gospel to them, and now, in their time of apostasy, he is teaching them the truth about their consequences that they face for leaving the faith of Christ to embrace the old law of Moses. Paul is certainly not their enemy, and he wants them to understand that. Moving into verse 17, he writes, "They zealously seek you in no good way. Nay, they desire to shut you out, that you may seek them." The Judaizers were fervent, and they were eager in their pursuit of the Gentile Christians. But Paul says that there was nothing good that would come of it. Their strategy was in part to convince them that Paul was not an authentic apostle and that he was not teaching them the whole truth. When Paul said their desire was to shut you out that you may seek them, his meaning was that he stood in the way of their designs. The Galatians were truly attached to Paul. They really cared a lot about him. And in order for the Judaizers to accomplish their ends, it was necessary to convince the Galatians to abandon that trust and that devotion that they had in Paul. The Judaizers knew that if they could succeed, if they were successful in convincing them and convincing the Galatians that Paul was not who he said he was, that they would stop seeking the counsel of Paul and seek after their counsel instead. So what they were trying to do is they were trying to drive a wedge between the Galatian Christians and Paul, so that instead of going to Paul for their advice and their instruction, that they would come to the Judaizers. They were trying to discredit Paul in any way that they could. Paul writes in verse 18, "But it is good to be zealously sought in a good matter at all times, and not only when I am present with you." Paul is saying that being zealously sought after is a good thing if those who are doing the seeking are genuinely acting in the best interest of others. But that is not the case in this instance. The Judaizers were intent on bringing the Gentile Christians under the bondage of the old law of Moses, and Paul has repeatedly told them that this was going to result in the condemnation of everyone involved, both the Judaizers and the Christians alike. They were all going to be condemned for this. By saying this, Paul is letting them know that he was not merely jealous of the attention the Galatians were getting from others. He wants them to know that being sought after by anyone is a good thing so long as they are being led in the right direction. He wants them to know that they need to be zealous for the truth whether he is there or not. That they need to be seeking after the truth. Then in verse 19, he writes, "My little children, of whom I am again in travail, until Christ be formed in you." Notice he said, "again in travail." Paul shows his affection of them by addressing them as his little children. Paul had been the chief overseer of the planning of the Galatian congregations of the Lord's church. As an apostle of Christ, he was personally directing the mission. Paul loved them like a father would love his children and addresses them in such a way as to communicate his love for them. Paul had used some pretty harsh words previously, and now he is using kind words so that his readership will know how he feels about the relationship that they have with one another. He addresses them as my little children. And then he goes on to say, "of whom I am again in travail." And two things that we notice here is the word again. There had been an agony of travail similar or comparable to that of a woman in childbirth. That's what that word means. This happening on Paul's part at the founding of those churches. Acts 13 and 14 document a lot of that pain that Paul went through while he was working in that region. They tried to kill him, and he's had an awful time with that. So he's equating that with pain like a woman giving childbirth. So, you know, Paul suffered greatly at the what you would say the planting of the Galatian churches. The second thing we need that it's evident in this was he was going through the same deep anxieties over them again at the prospect of losing them to the Judaizers. Paul's emotional state is just as bad for them now as it was when he was trying to evangelize them in the first place. Who in the world would want to lose their brothers and sisters after having gone through what Paul went through to evangelize them in the first place, to bring them the truth? How would that make anyone feel if after you had gone through a region and made many converts and had many congregations of the Lord's church established, only to find out later that they had just apostatized and they were lost with no hope? And that would be a serious blow. That would hurt. I've had people that I have studied with who came to Christ and they left. And it hurts. And I can only imagine how Paul must have felt. And he's telling them this here, that he's in travail, that he's in agony, he's suffering because he's worried about them. He goes on to write, until Christ be formed in you. The Galatian Christians' acceptance of Judaism had blurred and distorted the image of Christ in their hearts. And Paul wishes their knowledge of Christ to be perfectly formed within them. This is what the issue with the Judaizers was all about. They were inserting Moses where Christ ought to have been, exclusively. Concerning this very thing, Paul wrote in Romans 10:4, for Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes. And I read that out of the New King James Version. When Christ is fully formed within, there's no room for Moses. There's no room for the law of Moses. There's no room for anything else the Judaizers were trying to push over onto the Gentile Christians. If Christ is fully formed, then there's no room. The law of Moses cannot be there. In verse 20 he writes, But I could wish to be present with you now and to change my tone. Paul expresses his desire to be with them personally. He knows how much more effective he could be against the Judaizers if he were present, if he were there with them. He's also letting them know by telling them this how important they are to him. He wants them to know this, especially in this letter, because he has said some pretty harsh things, and he's not done with the harsh things. In verse 5, he lays it out, or in chapter 5, he lays it out on the line for them. And we're going to be looking at that in the weeks to come. He's not done. He's been pretty harsh. There's an old saying that I've heard that the barber always puts a little shaving cream on before he applies the razor. So Paul's kind of going back and forth between you know, telling them the consequences of their actions and then trying to make sure that they understand that he's acting in their best interest and he's genuinely concerned for their well-being. He doesn't want to just come down on them and tear them up and then leave them with the notion that he's mad at them or that he doesn't care about them, that he's just all gloom and doom and you all are not going to make it to heaven, it's terrible, it's awful, and then them not understand that he's doing this out of sincere love and affection for their souls, for their well-being. Go ahead, CL.
There in verse 16, he says, therefore, become an enemy, and by telling him the truth, he asks, there in the whole first part of the chapter, or in chapter 3, he's told them that the law has came to an end in place of Christ. I mean, that's what he taught them when he converted them.
Right.
He's going through this and telling them the same again. Now you're going back to the very thing that we learned was ended, and you're in this new thing. And so, I mean, when he teaches somebody, he doesn't just, he doesn't butt heads with you and tell you you're wrong right up front. He uses something to lead you to there. He uses the law to lead you up to the new stuff. And he's reviewing this. And then, am I your enemy because I'm telling you the truth? The law ended when Christ died. And you were converted to Christ. Now you're going back under the law again. You're essentially deputy Christ that you've already accepted.
And I'm quite sure that Paul went over all of this with them while he was there with them. I'm absolutely convinced that that's the case. That he is just rehashing a lot of things here that he's already told them. When you read in Romans, I don't know exactly where it's at, but he gives a real treatment of this, of the separation between the law of Moses and the law of Christ, if you will, the gospel, the system of faith that we live under. It's all references to the same thing. And in Ephesians, he gives a real treatment of that. And so Paul, he's being real thorough whenever he evangelizes these people. I'm sure he knows that the Judaizers are out there. And so he's been, very diligent to make sure that his converts are informed, if you will, as to the dangers of those that are out there. And when you read many of his epistles, he really gets into this in depth. He does a really good job of explaining it. It's I can kind of understand why in the beginning of the letter he called them foolish. Because without a doubt, in Paul's mind, they should have already known all this stuff. So thank you, CL, for
even down here in verse 20, then he said, I wish to be present with you now to change my tone. And in 1st and 2nd Corinthians, when he was written to them, I'm being awful hard on you on paper, and I would probably be, and he tells me that, and I would probably be different if I'm there in person than I am.
Right.
If you get upset with someone, if you sit down and write on a piece of paper, you probably tell them a whole lot more than if you actually meet them face to face, or, but you put everything down they need to know. Your emotions and your care for that person.
Right. You have to go out of your way. You have to go out of your way in a letter to make sure that somebody knows how you feel about them. Because if they're just reading text on a sheet of paper, in this case, whatever he was writing on, if all they're reading is just the text and there's none of the personableness of that, if that's a word, of the affection that he shows, then it would be easy for them to say, well, he's just railing on me, he's just chewing on me, this is all bad, there's nothing good. And then, you're not going to, you're just going to turn people off like that completely. And that's what Paul's doing. He's going back and forth. He's laying the facts out. He's not pulling any punches, but he's making sure that they understand that he loves them and that he considers them.
If he didn't care for them, he wouldn't be right.
Right, exactly. And that's kind of the way whenever I'm dealing with my kids, I tell them, if I didn't love you, you wouldn't be going through this right now. But still, it's... If you don't say it, if you don't put it on the paper, they probably won't understand that at the time. And I think that's what Paul's doing here. And to change my tone, for I am perplexed about you. Paul is admitting to his readership now here that the tone or manner in which he is communicating is indeed severe. It needs to be. The things he has been telling them are serious. Their acceptance of the Judaizing doctrine will cost each and every one of them their souls if they let it continue. Paul obviously does not like using this kind of tone with them, and he wants them to know that. Paul is practicing what he preached concerning this very thing, as we read in Ephesians 4, 14 through 15. And I'm reading this out of the New King James Version. Ephesians 4, starting in verse 14, that we should no longer be children tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine by the trickery of men and the cunning craftiness of deceitful plotting, but speaking the truth in love. Speaking the truth in love. May grow up in all things into Him who is the head, Christ. Paul is teaching them the truth. He cannot pull any punches. He can't say, well, you know, this Judaizing thing, you really shouldn't do that because you might be lost. It might put your souls in jeopardy. You know, it's not a good... You can't do that. You don't love them if you do that. And it's tough. It's tough. Whenever I deal with some of the people out in the workplace, and there comes a time whenever you've just got to... The rubber's got to hit the road. You just got to tell them. Point out, point blank. And it's tough. And it's hard. And a lot of the times, if it's not done tactfully, then you get a negative response. And I've had a bunch of them. A bunch. And I try to learn, you know, as I go through that, ways of softening it. But still, there are just some things that you cannot compromise on. You have to tell them the truth. And that's what Paul... That's Paul's situation right here. He has to tell them the truth. If he softens it, if he in any way leaves any doubt whatsoever that they're lost, then souls may be lost. He has to tell them. The consequences for Judaizing is... you will fall from grace. And he's going to tell him that here in the next chapter, just point blank. He said, you will fall from grace. This is a serious deal. It's serious for them and serious today. It's serious for all Christians living in this on this side of the cross. Are there any comments before we move on into the next part? Paul's going to shift gears here in a little bit. And we're going to get into the Hagar and Sarah illustration that he uses here in a few minutes. If not, then Galatians 4:21, he writes, tell me, ye that desire to be under the law, do you not hear the law? Let's keep in mind here that Paul's background is he's a Pharisee. He was a Pharisee. His entire letter to this point has been all about contrasting the law of Moses and the law of Christ. The main issue advocated by the Judaizers has been their claim that Gentile Christians had to become a son of Abraham before becoming a child of God. That's the main argument that the Judaizers have been setting forth here. Paul, being a Pharisee and a former student of the law under Gamaliel, means that he possessed a considerable knowledge of the law of Moses. The Judaizers have been pulling things out of the law of Moses in order to promote their doctrine. Now, Paul is about to use the very law that they were advocating to illustrate the point that he has been making about the bondage of the old law and the freedom that we have in the law of Christ under the gospel. To make this distinction, he chooses two sons of Abraham, Isaac and Ishmael, to make his point. This is no accident that Paul chose the sons of Abraham for the lesson he's about to present to his readership. He chose the sons of Abraham in order to make a point against the claims by the Judaizers that Gentiles had to become sons of Abraham first before coming to Christ. And I thought that was pretty interesting as I was getting into that. I've never really thought about that. Whenever I read of the contrast that he set between the two, and then when I realized, well, yeah, he's been telling them all along that they don't have to go through the law of Moses to be a son of Abraham. So why not use a son of Abraham to make your point? That's just kind of logical, isn't it? But anyway, I thought that was really interesting when I was doing my study on that. Galatians 4:22, for it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by the handmaid and one by the free woman. First, we need to understand from verse 24 that we'll get to here in a minute, is Paul is using the account of Isaac and Ishmael to illustrate the contrast between the bondage of the law of Moses and the freedom of the law of Christ. He is laying out the facts that he is going to use to make his comparison. The free woman in Paul's illustration here is Sarah, who was the wife of Abraham, as recorded in Genesis 17 and verse 15, which reads, "Then God said to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name." The handmaid here in Sarah is Sarah's Egyptian slave, whose name is Hagar. She's identified in Genesis 16:1 and falling. And following, Abraham's wife, Sarah, had been unable to bear Abraham a son. So in her grief over this predicament, she decided it would be a good idea to have Hagar, her handmaid, bear Abraham a son in her stead. Hagar did bear Abraham that son. His name was Ishmael. And Sarah was unable to cope with the results of this arrangement. And Hagar ended up being cast out of Abraham's household. Well, I hate to quit this right in the middle of it, but the bell has rung. This is really interesting. I really enjoyed getting into this. And next Lord's Day, Lord willing, we'll get into it. Thank you all so very much.